If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine, Britain's best-selling history magazine. I'm Ellie Cawthorne. What caused the Spanish Armada to set sail for England in 1588? What did Queen Elizabeth I really say in her famous speech at Tilbury? And what really led to the invading forces' defeat? These are just some of the questions addressed in today's Everything You Wanted to Know episode, all about the Spanish Armada. Our expert for today's episode is Dr. Robert Hutchinson, and putting your questions to him was our acting digital editor, Eleanor Evans.
Our topic for today's Everything You Wanted to Know podcast episode is the defeat of the Spanish Armada in 1588. And our expert is Dr. Robert Hutchinson, a Tudor historian and archaeologist whose critically acclaimed books have been translated into 11 languages. He's a regular broadcaster on British, American, German, Japanese and Australian television. And thanks so much for joining us today, Robert.
Thank you very much indeed. An exciting topic to talk about, because the Tudors invented propaganda in our modern sense of propaganda. And we live with myths which the Tudors created to this day. I mean, there's a myth that here is David fighting this gigantically powerful Goliath of naval power. It's not true. In fact, the Armada had fewer ships at sea fighting the English than the English. The English had, 70 more ships than they did. The Spanish had fewer guns than the English, 138 heavy guns compared to the English's 251. They had a third less firepower. So that myth has to be blown away. And there's many more fascinating aspects of this campaign which most people don't know about. And this is our chance to remedy that.
Absolutely. Well, we've had some fascinating listener questions. And if I can just remind listeners, the format of this episode, we're looking at popular search queries around the subject, as well as listener questions. So thank you to everybody who's got in touch on social media. And so, Robert, if we can start at the very beginning then, how before these myths start building up, the question that's most commonly put to Google in this case is, what was the Spanish Armada?
Right. Well, first of all, a little bit of background. Philip II of Spain, the King of Spain, had ruled England jointly with his second wife, Mary I, before her death 30 years before. And he wanted to overthrow Mary's half-sister, Elizabeth, because she was Protestant and had returned England to Protestantism. So Philip wanted to make England Catholic again, preferably with one of his relatives as the new monarch. So he decided to launch the Spanish Armada, 129 ships tasked with invading England in 1588 and bring it back to the Vatican. So it was planned by that the Lord Chief Admiral of Spain, Santa Cruz, but he died in February 1588, and the operational command was taken over by Alonso de Guzman, the Duke of Medina Sidonia. Now, there were lots of other admirals. I mean, the Armada actually sailed with 10 admirals in its ships. They were far more skilled, far more experienced. They had knowledge of naval warfare, which Sidonia didn't have. He was an administrator. He was a pen pusher. And he took on the job, I have to say, rather unwillingly, not only because of his lack of military experience, but he's also terrified of seasickness. But Philip was a micromanager, and he admired Medina Sidonia's attention to detail and paperwork skills, and so therefore he insisted on him taking command of the Armada. Now, the English fleet was commanded by Charles Howard, Baron Effingham, Lord High Admiral of England from 1585, and he wisely appointed experienced naval commanders, Sir Francis Drake, Sir Martin Frobisher, Sir John Hawkins, all as skilled subordinate commanders.
Okay, that's a fantastic introduction. And is it worth saying something about Elizabeth I here as well? What was sort of her situation in England? How established was she in her rule at this stage?
Right. Well, you have to remember that the Tudor dynasty was unbelievably insecure. Its claim to the throne was pretty legally tenuous. It only achieved by Henry VII winning the Battle of Bosworth. So all five Tudor monarchs all faced other people who had better or equal claims to the throne than they did. They all faced rebellions as well. So it's an insecure monarchy. And when Elizabeth came to the throne in 1588, she returned it to the Protestant Church. But more than half of her subjects were Catholic. And the religious changes sparked an uprising against her in November 1569 in the north of England. Like all the other Tudors, they put down any kind of disloyalty ruthlessly. And the damage that that suppression caused left the north of England in economic parlous state for several centuries afterwards. In February 1570, Pope Pius V signed a papal bull that excommunicated Elizabeth and deprived her of any pretended right to the English throne, which she had monstrously usurped. He also excommunicated any of her subjects who obeyed Elizabeth or her laws or commandments, and unwittingly, therefore, made every English Catholic a potential traitor and even an assassin in the eyes of Elizabeth's ministers. So a number of Vatican-inspired assassination plots duly followed, uncovered and destroyed by Sir Francis Walsingham, Elizabeth's spymaster, who also hunted down all these Catholic priests who were sent into England to comfort and expand the Catholic population. Now, the execution of Mary, Queen of Scots, myth number one, the Catholic pretender to the throne of England in February 1587, wasn't a reason for the Armada sailing. It'd been mobilising for some time because Philip was incensed by English privateers attacking the gold and silver convoys coming across the Atlantic from Spain's possessions in the New World. And more importantly, since 1585, Elizabeth had been secretly aiding the Dutch rebels in the Spanish Netherlands with troops and cash. And she believed, obviously, it was much better to fight the Spanish on somebody else's territory rather than English soil. And Drake, Sir Francis Drake, El Draco, as the Spanish called him, was a thorn in Philip's side, and he had continually attacked Spanish possessions and even had briefly occupied ports in northwest Spain and had raided the Canary and Cape Verde Islands. And Philip had had enough. He asked his nephew, Alexander Farnese, the Duke of Parma, to plan an expeditionary force to cross from Flanders and land near Cape Margate. And his naval commanders were instructed to create a fleet that can control the seas and protect that expeditionary force as it crossed.
So 1588 then, it sounds like this is obviously the result of a huge amount of historical tension and the roots go way back. So is it fair to say there's no sort of one event that triggers this sailing? It's a build-up of many different factors.
It's a build-up of many things. And Elizabeth's privateers were hitting Philip in his pocket. The gold and silver were being sequestered by them. His pride was damaged by these raids on Spanish possessions and even on the Spanish mainland. But most of all, this is Elizabeth secretly aiding the rebels, which were causing him more expense, more angst, and more woes in his possessions in the Spanish Low Countries.
Okay, so if we can see Philip, obviously that motive they're building with him, and he's preparing for this confrontation. We've got a question here from Zoe Maureen on Instagram. Thanks, Zoe, who asks, how did England prepare for the invasion, or how much were the general populace aware that this was happening?
Well, Zoe, that's a good question, because here we have a country where the English government believed firmly that if the Spanish had invaded, half the population would come to their assistance, the Catholic half. And so they were in a very tight space, but they had the advantage of good intelligence. Walsingham's spies had informed him of the naval preparation. He even had a spy in the household of the first commander, Santa Cruz. He knew the Spanish order of battle almost at the same time as the Spanish did. And he also tried other methods, economic warfare, to try and slow up the dispatch of the Spanish Armada, to give England time to prepare to defend itself. So he persuaded the Italian banks to refuse credit to Philip, thereby starving him of funds, and he was forced to go cap in hand to the new Pope, Sixtus V, for loans. Now, unfortunately, Sixtus was pretty stingy, and he had more likings, it was said, for ducats than devotions. And after much delay, the pontiff promised the equivalent of, in today's money, £662 million to Philip, but he cannily stipulated, because he liked his ducats, that the first half was only to be paid when the first Spanish soldier landed on English soil, and the remainder paid in equal instalments every month afterwards. So Philip was paying out £40 million a month on the preparations for the Armada, and the Spanish economy, was only saved by the timely arrival of another bullion fleet from the New World. So in England, the Tudor bureaucrats drew up lists of ships which could be leased or commandeered to augment the Navy Royal, which it was called in those days. They mobilised the militia, they bought weaponry, they surveyed the coast from Hampshire to Dorset for likely landing places that could be fortified. Drake argued that England shouldn't wait. England should mount a preemptive strike on the Armada to buy more time. Elizabeth was very dubious about this. Here's a woman in a man's world who's having to gamble with very little resources, and one wrong roll of the dice could leave her in real trouble. And she was loath to allow some of her precious warships to go with Drake for this preemptive strike. She was prevailed upon to allow them to do it. And so he sailed to Cadiz in 1587 and destroyed 24 ships. But more importantly, he burnt a year's supply of barrel staves and hoops. Now, that doesn't sound very exciting, not much daring doing in burning barrels. But in fact, this is going to prove a disaster for the Armada, because the following year, all its food and fresh water had to be stored in unseasoned casks. And that quickly rotted the food, and it leaked drinking water. And that was one of the problems the Spanish faced. Now, in terms of defending England, the army was divided into two groups. The first, under the Earl of Leicester, was 30,000 strong, and they would fight the Spanish after they landed in force. Now, the English believed the Spanish would come up the English Channel and attack London. And they stretched booms attached to ships' masts across the Thames. Didn't work. First tide came and swept away the ships' masts. So their defences were pretty ramshackle. So we've got a mobile army who's going to swoop down on the invading force. Interestingly, the second army under Lord Hunsdon, who was a cousin of Elizabeth, was 4,000 men greater. And that was tasked with defending the sacred person of the Queen. She would remain in London and have Windsor Castle as the last redoubt, the place where she'd make her last stand. The Tudors couldn't afford to have standing armies. And so they were largely made up of ill-equipped militia who had no military training or discipline. The commander of the Dorset militia firmly believed that his men would sooner kill each other than actually fighting the enemy. And many lacked helmets, some without even a sword. They had bows and arrows, they didn't have many muskets. But they were going to be concentrated near major ports, and they would employ this scorched earth tactic to slow up any invasion by destroying bridges, burning crops, driving off farm animals to deny any food to the invader until the main defence force arrived. The English fleet was divided into two parts. One was based in Dover to interdict the amphibious landing coming across from Flanders, the other under Drake at Plymouth to intercept the armada coming up through the western approaches. So everyone was aware of this national emergency. The menfolk had disappeared into the ranks, and the stay-behinds could see the chain of warning beacons being built on the hilltops all along the English Channel. It was the first war in which propaganda played an important part, and government indoctrination warned them of the dire consequences of Spanish success: looting, pillaging, rapine. And they even talked about specially and evilly designed whips and scourges, which they were going to punish the English for opposing them.
How would this propaganda have been spread among the people of England?
Through broadsheets, printed broadsheets. I mean, the Tudors knew how to employ the power of the printing press. So these proclamations and this propaganda would be nailed up in marketplaces, handed out and read out at meetings, because not everybody, of course, could read.
That's so interesting. And so if the scene is set then and the preparations have been made as much as they could, if we can dig into then the fleets themselves, we've had a couple of questions here about what types of ships were used by both sides. And Frank Schumacher has asked, was the Spanish Armada really so behind in naval technology?
Good question, Frank. And the answer is yes. Elizabeth's navy had 38 ships, and they were mobilised in October 1587. Four of them dated from Henry VIII's reign of four decades ago. But 11 had been built in the previous 4 years, and a further 12 had been rebuilt to modern standards. And these modern standards had an innovative English design called race-built. The hulls were race-built, which reduced the height of the raised platforms at the bow and stern. The one in the front was called forecastle, which is the origin of the forecastle, which he still used with names of ships. They lengthened the gun deck, and this produced a sleeker hull, which made them much faster and much more manoeuvrable in the water than the Spanish ships. Several warships were designed specifically to operate in the shoaled waters between England and Flanders, drawing only 12 feet of water, but those rolled alarmingly in the heavy seas, so they weren't great ships to serve on. Now, in addition to the Navy Royal, Elizabeth's fleet had 52 large merchant ships hired for their crews, their trained crews, and their gun armaments. The City of London paid for leasing a further 30 ships, and there were also volunteer ships as well. And most of them served in the Western Squadron, based at Plymouth. Dover, there were 26 coastal ships in addition to its warships. So the English fleet therefore numbered 208 ships of all types, with 16,000 crews. And as I said right at the start, despite some beliefs, it was actually larger than the Armada. Now, the Armada had 129 ships organised in 10 squadrons. And the warships were great galleons, much bigger than most of the English ships, much less manoeuvrable. And they had hulks, which were used for transporting food and men. So of the 129, 70 were warships with sizable contingents of troops on board, because the Spanish believed naval warfare was just another kind of land warfare. That's why they had lots of troops on board. They believed in boarding ships and capturing them and killing the crews rather than sinking them. Within that 129, there were four galleys propelled by slaves at oars, and two of those were wrecked on the way up on the coast of France. And there were also four galleasses, which are gun platforms with sails and oars, and they were useful to manoeuvre in flat calms, the devastating effect. In the Battle of Portland, the English were worried about the galleasses actually cutting out some of the English ships from the rest of the fleet. So in terms of naval technology, the English had also perfected the art of firing broadsides with guns made and mounted specifically for naval warfare, whereas the Spanish had land artillery on huge carriages. So the faster and more agile English ships could hold their adversaries below the waterline. They could come up behind and actually fire through their sterns for the entire length of the ship. Terrible destruction, and head off before the Spanish could reply. They also had a faster rate of fire. So the English were rather like hounds harrying their quarry. The other problem the Spanish had, as I mentioned just now, these were huge artillery carriages they had. You had to pull them back on the Spanish ships inboard to load them. And that's a slow and cumbersome business. And the crews were soldiers. Now, if they were massing to board a ship, you actually lost the people to fire your guns because they were detailed to other duties. And their rate of fire was much lower than the English. Now, one ship only fired 104 rounds in anger. Now, we know how much gunpowder was loaded on board because of the cargo manifest at Lisbon. And it was those 104 rounds in anger, fired in anger, was less than half than the Spanish that ship had used for saluting or ceremonial purposes. So the Spanish had fewer heavy guns to the English. They had less ships. They were not so manoeuvrable. They were slow and ponderous, and their guns didn't work in any way as fast or as effective as the English.
Okay, brilliant. Well, I hope that answers your question, Frank. An excellent answer there. Thanks, Robert. And one we've got as well from Matt LFC, which kind of leads in from that one. He's asked, what was the makeup of the crew on the Spanish side? You mentioned the galleys carrying enslaved people, but do we know much about where people were from?
Yes, I mean, most of them came from northwest Spain. There were 7,700 sailors and 18,703 soldiers on the crew lists of the Spanish Armada, which still exist. Most were Spanish, There were some Italians, but there was also, interestingly, quite a substantial contingent of exiled English Catholics on board. And they ran into trouble in the later battle, which the Armada was involved in, when some of them were run ashore and were captured by Dutch rebels. So their fates were sealed.
Still to come on the History Extra podcast.
They actually carried on board the Armada a prefabricated fort, which they were going to erect on the Margate landing beaches to protect those beaches for resupply. If they had landed, the ill-trained, ill-equipped militia would have been no matches for them. And I think if they had landed, they would probably have been in the streets of London only a week or so after landing.
Okay, interesting stuff. Well, before we go into the battle itself then, we've had quite a few questions about a speech that was made by Elizabeth I. It's a very famous speech. I'm sure many listeners will be familiar with a bunch of information around it, which we're going to talk about today. So we've had a question here from Al Wehrmuth on Instagram, who's asked, is it true? Did the speech actually happen or was it just propaganda?
Good question. I mean, lots of people have debated about this. We know what Elizabeth said because her words were jotted down by Leicester's chaplain, a man called Dr. Lionel Sharp. And of course, the words were also promulgated afterwards. Propaganda. And here's the Queen on a white charger wearing a breastplate, an armoured breastplate, and carrying a marshal's baton. And she did make this speech on the 19th of August, 1588, at Leicester's headquarters at a fort called Tilbury on the Thames estuary. It was pure propaganda. Here she is saying she had the body but of a weak and feeble woman, but I had the heart and the stomach of a king. Great words, cleverly written. But of course, she was warning of the dangers of a Spanish invasion, but she knew very well that the Armadas were in full retreat as she made that speech, northwards up the North Sea after this bruising battle off the coast of Holland. Even though they pretended to keep up the tension by spreading rumours that there had been a landing on the coast of France, on the coast of Kent, it was propaganda. And indeed, Elizabeth was always parsimonious, always worried about the size of her exchequer, started demobilising her forces almost immediately after making the speech. So it was propaganda, but it was great propaganda. It's great prose, it's stirring stuff, and it shows the mettle of Elizabeth I. Even though she knew very well it was just propaganda.
Well, I think that I've skipped us ahead a little bit there. So perhaps we could go back to the battle and how this plays out before we get to Elizabeth's speech.
So the Spanish are sighted. They come up the channel in a crescent-shaped formation. Difficult for the English to fight. The English, the Western fleet, have to be towed out of Plymouth. The early encounters were pretty inconclusive. Indeed, most of the encounters were pretty inconclusive. The damage suffered by the Armada, they'd lost a few ships coming up in some awful storms, but the first damage they suffered was by accident when two ships collided with each other and another one blew up. And the English battered the Armada, but they actually hadn't stopped it. Neither had they defeated it. So when they arrived off the coast of, when the Armada arrived off the coast of Calais, the threat was still real. And that's when they started using fire ships. A galleass was destroyed in Calais Harbour. But by the time it came to the end game, the battle off the coast of Holland, the Armada was basically intact and still a viable threat. So one asks oneself, you know, why didn't the English land a stunning blow? One of the reasons for that was the thing I mentioned just now, Elizabeth's parsimony. They didn't have enough gunpowder. They had to actually keep going by using stocks of gunpowder on those two Spanish ships which were damaged and which they had captured. They had the advantage of being close to home. So they could be resupplied with food and water, ammunition. But they were using up the ammunition and gunpowder at a furious rate. But by the time the Spanish had arrived off the coast of Calais, they were still a very viable and dangerous threat, amplified, one might say, by an unfortunate piece of timing, that the militia at Dover mutinied because they hadn't been paid. So the idea of a national emergency was being wrapped up quite considerably. It was do or die if the Spanish Armada could be attacked in a set-piece battle off the coast of Holland, and it was.
Okay, so what plays out next?
Well, again, the Armada was battered. They lost a few ships. Some were grounded on the coast of Holland. But at the end of that day's fighting, they were still a fighting force. But they were short of water because of these leaky casks. They were short of food. And the morale was blown away. And for reasons which people still dispute to this day, the decision was taken to go home. And they sailed northwards to go round the coast of north coast of Scotland and down the west coast of Ireland and so to home. An amazing decision to take. The charts they had were pretty limited. They had no idea of what problems they would face in those unknown shores. They were in desperate states in terms of water. I mean, off the coast of Newcastle, they threw all their horses and donkeys over the side because they couldn't water them. And then they hit what basically was a cyclone. This series of unbelievable storms, which began to sink all the Spanish Armada ships, and they were basically told, every man for himself, head home as best you can. And large numbers were sunk off the coast of Scotland, the coast of the Hebrides, and most of all, down the west coast of Scotland. Those who survived the shipwrecks were killed by the English or the Irish, or captured and ransomed. In terms of, you know, how many were lost by the Spanish, we don't know how many Spanish were killed in the running fight up the Channel or in that battle. We know only anecdotal information, like the decks of the flagship were piled high with corpses 40 deep. But the Spanish believed they'd lost about 6,000 drowned or afterwards killed by English soldiers or Irish peasants off the coast of Ireland. Recent documentary research suggests that, in fact, the number was 3,750 who died from either drowning, or hunger or disease after coming ashore. 1,500 were killed after surviving shipwreck, and there were 750 survivors in Ireland. Of those, 108 major combatant ships out of the 129, 58 returned to Spain, 54% of those who sailed. So almost half the major warships didn't get back, and the number's greater if you include the little messenger dispatch vessels. They had even greater losses. Now, in terms of English casualties, the Tudors cared nothing for casualties in their wars. So we don't have any numbers or any credible estimates of English losses other than the fact that half of them had fought in the Armada were dead from disease or starvation within months of the victory. Elizabeth spent a total of £167,000 on fighting the campaign. That's about £470 million in current money. And just £180 of that went on government rewards for the injured. The amount of bad feeling this caused was such that when they had their victory celebrations at St. Paul's Cathedral afterwards, there was some concern whether the procession would be attacked by discontented soldiers and sailors. But interestingly, in 1590, Drake and Lord Howard of Effingham and other sailors created this Chatham chest, where everybody in the fleet contributed 6 pennies to pay for the upkeep and welfare of injured sailors who'd been hurt in warfare. The Chatham chest still survives today. There's a building in Chatham which houses a number of disabled mariners. That was a direct result of the Spanish Armada campaign.
That's such an interesting welfare initiative. Like, had that happened in any conflicts before, do you know, or was this a...
It was the first time. And I think it was because of the losses in through disease amongst the fleet almost immediately after the defeat of the Armada. I mean, Lord Howard of Effingham was selling off the family silver to try and pay for the medical care of these people dying from typhus and cholera.
Okay, well, we did have a listener question on that. So Christy May asked how many lives were lost. So I think that really addresses that point very well. And there obviously were, on the Spanish side, these very significant losses. And just to revisit some points you've made already in terms of the turning points of the water and the weather, we've had quite a few listener questions. Anna Larini, James Dallin, Colin McCormack, thank you all for your questions on how much did weather and luck play a part ultimately?
These are crucial questions, and it's all about is about weather, and it's about luck, but it's also strategic issues where the Spanish were pretty bad. I mean, here we've got Philip, who is sending dispatches to the fleet, you know, 20 a day, taking micromanaging decisions on a fleet 600 miles away. The plan was always going to be pretty tricky to achieve. They were instructed by Philip not to get involved in a fight. Don't stop. Keep going. Concentrate on joining up with Palmer's army and guard his assault launched from Flanders. Strategic mistake number one. If they had bottled up the Western fleet in Plymouth Harbour, England would have faced catastrophe. If they had captured the Isle of Wight, which had practically no viable defences, it would have been difficult for them to be winkled out from a position commanding the English Channel and the Portsmouth naval base. Communications between the Armada and Palmer failed completely. Medina Sedona kept sending dispatch vessels up to Flanders and heard nothing back. When the Armada arrived off Calais, to his horror, he discovered that Palmer wasn't ready to invade. Not one soldier or one horse had been embarked on these barges. Now, on the English side, I've talked about their serious lack of gunpowder, their failure to inflict a telling and killing blow, and the accidents involving these ships. I mean, more Armada ships were damaged by accident than by the English. But it was the storms that actually did the damage, coming up from Spain, and then while they retreated round the north coast of Scotland and down the west side of Ireland. That was what later the Dutch called the Protestant wind. That's what did the damage.
Okay, so very interesting points there. And we've got a question here from Emma Lai Klassen, who has asked whether it's true, you mentioned some Spanish sailors ended up on the west coast of Ireland. And Emma has asked, is it true there are descendants of Spanish survivors who married local women there? Is there anything known about that?
Yes. As I've said, many of the Spanish survivors were killed by English forces. Others were captured and ransomed. Some Spanish soldiers entered the service of an Irish magnate, Hugh O'Neill, the Earl of Tyrone, and served with him for some time. 8 years later, there were still eight still serving in his household. So it's entirely plausible that some married local women. The rest of the Spanish who were captured were, as I say, ransomed off. Elizabeth was always interested in making money. And they had a pretty tough time. A lot of them didn't actually get back to Spain for quite a long time. They spent their time in Bridewell Prison in London and in Dublin. Awful time. But there again, if you're a prisoner of war in the Tudor period, you know, your life was only worth the ransom. If you didn't have rich relatives back home, you were a goner.
Okay, if we can allow ourselves a little speculation then, we've got a question here from Hamish Ross in New Zealand, who asks, had the Spanish successfully landed in England, what were their prospects for success in battle on land and ultimate conquest?
Well, Hamish, I mean, amphibious warfare, amphibious landings is the riskiest type of military operation you could ever conceive of. Success depends on a whole range of imponderables, tides, wind, weather, or the scale of risk of attack when you're at sea, which is when you're most vulnerable, all these people bobbing around in the water. What you don't want is the enemy getting in amongst you. So the other aspect is if you're bottled up on the beaches, you've got nowhere to go apart from the sea. So it's the most riskiest kind of military operation you can plan. And this was probably the riskiest in history. The idea of towing barges with troops and horses on board across 30 or 40 miles of choppy water is astonishing. Just a rough sea could have actually just disrupted the whole thing. The most important thing, as far as the Spanish was concerned, was local sea control. They needed to build a protected corridor for this huge flotilla of towed barges to sail inside, because they don't want the fast-moving English ships getting in amongst them and causing mayhem. I mean, they are sitting ducks. But the Spanish planning was pretty thorough. They actually carried on board the Armada a prefabricated fort, which they were going to erect on the Margate landing beaches to protect those beaches for resupply. Now, Kent and Margate aren't very far away from London. Palmer's army were battle-hardened veterans. Lots of them were mercenaries. They were tough guys. If they had landed, the ill-trained, ill-equipped militia would have been no matches for them. And I think if they had landed, they would probably have been in the streets of London only a week or so after landing.
Oh, what a compelling possibility. It's very interesting, isn't it? Okay, so we've got a few questions then. James Snelling and Alex Plotkin have both asked variations of what is the significance of England's defeat of the Spanish Armada? I guess we can say what happened next.
Okay, well, I mean, this was a terrible blow to Spanish prestige. The perception of Spain as one of the superpowers of the 16th century. Aside from the Dutch rebels and the Protestants in Germany, the remainder of Europe was staunchly Catholic, and they were astonished and horrified at the scale of the Armada's defeat. They initially believed the Armada had won. The Spanish had propaganda too. The Dutch struck a medal celebrating how a Protestant wind had intervened to defeat the Spanish. And before the campaign, public opinion in England wasn't wholly supportive of Elizabeth. Some ship owners sent their vessels overseas to prevent them being commandeered for active service. Many clergy refused to contribute money to pay for the militia. And worse yet, 12 Bristol merchants were caught supplying Spain with cargoes of ammunition and gunpowder and ordnance. They made a pretty grim fate, I suspect. So opinion in England was divided. And don't forget, the government expected the Catholic population to come in on the Spanish side if they invaded. So Spanish diplomatic power was damaged by this crippling defeat. But Philip was undeterred, and he continued to expend resources on invading England, even though the English had tried an attack to try and sink the remaining Armada ships, failed because Drake was more interested in plunder. And quite interesting, in July 1595, four Spanish galleys landed at Mosul in Cornwall, burnt the village and the church, sailed on to Penzance, which was also burnt, as was Newlyn. And they left 12 days after celebrating a Catholic mass openly on English soil. And only three Cornishmen were killed, and that's because the militia ran away. There were further armadas in 1596, 120 ships, again caught in fierce storms off the Galician coast, and they headed home. And in the following year, 1597, when 136 ships sailed with plans to land at Falmouth in Cornwall. Once again, 9 days into the voyage, a three-day northeast storm sank 28, when they were only 28 miles off Cornwall. So maybe the Dutch had a point about the Protestant wind. After the death of Elizabeth in 1603, the new king, James I, wanted an end to the crippling war with Spain, which had been carrying on all those years. The Treaty of London, signed in August 1604, ended the conflict, ironically granting most of the Spanish demands, such as support for the Dutch rebellion, and renouncing privateer attacks on Spanish shipping. So the treaty basically gave the Spanish everything they wanted, despite those three armadas and this war which had been carrying on for decades. So what we believe, as I say, right at the outset, is about the campaign against the Armada is a myth shaped by that 500-year-old propaganda. England was saved by her navy. And in the aftermath, for the first time, there was the sense of nationhood about England. It created the sense of nationhood. The Spanish trade embargoes forced the English to trade elsewhere with Russia, Africa. And Elizabeth signed a charter creating the East India Company. That was the crucible which actually founded the British Empire. So out of the Spanish Armada came the realization of just how important a strong navy is. But also, you could say, it was a major factor in creating the British Empire.
Right. And do you think then that those factors are the reasons why it's loomed so large in public memory today?
No, I think it's more the romance of the thing. Here we have these foreigners with seemingly overwhelming force being, because of the myth says that they were defeated by the brave and plucky Englishmen in their little ships. Wasn't quite that, but patriotism is a powerful emotion, and that's what has been fed by this propaganda. That's what harbours these myths, even to the present day.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so much, Robert, today for all of these answers. And I would ask perhaps to wrap things up. Where would you point anyone towards if they would like to find out more? Any of your own work, for example?
Well, that's a kind thought. I did write a book on the Spanish Armada, which is a blow-by-blow account, not only of the action, but of the intelligence war and the propaganda war that went on, and includes a lot of very little known facts because it's based on contemporary documents. I must just finish with one little piece of propaganda which the government disseminated after the Spanish Armada retreated. And it's in the British Library. It's a printed set of verses printed in black letter type. And it's all about, it's a government's first official health warning on record. And it's all about, is it safe to eat fish if they've been feeding on the diseased corpses, mainly with venereal disease, diseased corpses of Spanish sailors? And back came the answer, yes, it is. This is how you prepare your fish. Black propaganda. But I love it as the first government health warning.
That was Robert Hutchinson. You can find out more about the defeat of the Spanish Armada, including a helpful written guide by Robert, on our website at historyextra.com/Spanish-Armada. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Ben Hewitt, Jack Bateman, and Brittany Colley.